Before the great god, the dread lord of the west, speak fair words for Jake Stratton Kent. May he flourish in the place of the weighing of hearts, by the marsh of the dead where the crocodiles nourish, their lives on the lost where the serpent upstarts. For though I be joined to the earth, in the innermost shrine of heaven am I. I was master of Thebes from my birth. Shall I die like a dog? Thou shalt not let me die. But my coup from the teeth of the crocodile sever shall be mighty in heaven forever and ever. By Peter Gray. May you rest in the chaos of creation, Jake Stratton Kent. Thank you for all that you've done, and may your work live on in infamy.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the Feast of Torches. I'm your host Azazel, and on today's episode we'll be feasting upon the topic of familiars, with our amazing guest BJ Swain, author of our new book, Familiar Unto Me, Witches, Sorcerers, and Their Spirit Companions. Aside from being an author, BJ is a practicing magician and host of the blog Glory of the Stars, which I'll be writing a link in the bio. Other than being an all-around badass and inspiration for other occultists like myself, is there anything else you'd like the listeners to know about you, BJ?
I mean, I've been involved in magical practice and witchcraft and occultism since I was a little kid, so for about 30 years at this point. And it's something that's woven generally into my life and has been a big focus. So I think that's probably the main thing of interest for most people.
Well, that's pretty awesome. That's a pretty long time. What got you specifically into looking into, I guess, focusing a lot more on spirits? Because I know a lot of, because I've also been in, you know, the witchcraft and magical occult scene for like 15 years, and I've definitely noticed there tends to be, at least in the neo-pagan community, there's a big separation of like focusing directly with spirits. I think there's a lot of trauma, I guess Christian trauma, and thinking that, you know, spirits are evil and healing from that, and not really knowing how to go directly in there without that kind of background into it.
I guess for me, it's always been part of the focus pretty much. When I was a little kid, I would see ghosts and spirits, and there was a particular spirit that kind of helped me navigating through that. And then that spirit helped introduce me to other nature spirits. And that was kind of my introduction to figuring out a lot of magic naturally on my own, was kind of working with those spirits and learning things from them. And so from a very young age, like early elementary school, the idea that spirits were around was just a natural part of the world. It wasn't something that was like I had to get into magic and discover that. And even with being brought up in a Christian household, my father had some interest in magic and psychism and astrology and things along those lines. And my mother is a seventh daughter of a seventh daughter. And so she grew up seeing things, being told that she was a witch, and experiencing things along those lines. And so when I had experiences like that, my parents were not super keen on the ghosts and the spirits, but if it was stuff like, oh, I had a dream and I know this is a dream that's going to come true, then we'd like talk about it and like look at how to deal with it. Or if I was like, oh, I can feel this thing from these people, then they're like, oh yeah, no, that's a good skill. Like, you should hone that. So it was a pretty positive environment for things like that. And then there were other things more directly that they were open to teaching me and showing me as well. So I think I was just lucky that I kind of had a childhood that was fertile for that type of learning and experience. And so when I got into, and even with the Christian aspects, my mother was very, very kind of literalist and very, very involved in church going. My father, on the other hand, was very open and free about those things and was like, you don't really need a church. You don't really need those institutions. It's about you and your relationship with God, and kind of do your own thing, figure your own thing out. And so even my exposure to Christianity was one that was simultaneously very deep and very involved, but also one that was very mm-hmm. open and very personal. And so growing up, like learning to pray, the idea was very much like it's a conversation. And so you expect to get feelings and inspiration and thoughts back. And so that idea that the divine and spiritual powers were real and communicative and something that you would engage with directly was there from the beginning. And so when I started exploring neo-paganism and magic through neo-paganism, because like the first book on magic that my dad got me when I was like 11 was a book on Celtic neo-paganism, where looking back in it, just about everything in it was just made up, but it still had enough like magic tech that I mm-hmm. was able to do some stuff. And so I guess as a little Christian kid going through confirmation and reading this book on neo-paganism, my initial approach was to kind of take the these gods, when it talks about gods and mythological figures, they're like pools of energy, and they're like energy with these characteristics, and that's the way I can understand it in a Christian mindset. And then I started actually engaging with it and doing it. It's like, oh no, these are like people, they're actual mm-hmm. beings. And so that was just kind of from the get-go, the approach. And when I was about like 15 or so, I started hanging out on forums and message boards on AOL. And it's honestly a really great experience as far as being developmental and introducing me to a lot of people who took magic seriously and actually practiced it and expected results and expected things to happen from it and treated it as real. But it drove me crazy how many people were just like, oh, it's psychology, oh, they're archetypes. And mm-hmm. I couldn't stand that. I was just like, no, things are real. Like, spirits are real, gods are real, like, this is, it's all real. And so there was a little while around 2010, 2012-ish, that range, where I kind of stepped back from some of the online magic community. And when I sort of resurfaced, it was like, whoa, everyone believes in spirits now. What happened? So, but it was great. It was great seeing that development. And it's kind of interesting seeing how, like, there's, I guess, like you said, in the neo-pagan community, which is much bigger, where you've still got those kind of pockets where there's, you've got sort of your manifestation crowd, where it's like they don't mm-hmm. really want to do rituals or spells. They just want positive thinking and creative visualization, and they don't.
Yeah, affirmations.
Yep. And then you've got kind of your people who are still in the, it's all in your head, it's whatever you want to do, it's all you. And then you've mm-hmm. got people who are like, yeah, let's go down to the crossroads and rub dirt all over ourselves and be swamp witches and talk to like the spirits of the bog. So it's a very wide range there. It's interesting seeing that range and how it plays out. I think it would be great if there was more crossover in some of the literature and some of the media and the teaching, so that some of those people who don't get exposed to as much stuff that's as deep and meaty or well-researched, if they had a little more access to that, and then could make kind of an informed decision about like, okay, is stirring my tea and thinking positive thoughts like really all I want in my life? Or maybe can I do that, but also talk to the spirits in my garden or something like that?
Yeah, I think for sure I want to say that because I watch a lot of magical media, like in pop culture and stuff. And I think I definitely noticed when that show Salem came out on, I don't remember what channel it was.
WGN.
Yeah. And it focused a lot more. I guess it was more of like a traditional witchcraft kind of mentality, the way that they kind of presented things. Mm-hmm. And I noticed a lot more in the books that were coming out and the focus that was shifting from a lot of like the new like Love and Light kind of crowd was like shifting towards like the tradcraft stuff.
Yeah.
And then that kind of, obviously tradcraft, it's you notice a lot more of the spirit focus in a lot of those books. And so, and then also, you know, you have Jake Sharon Kent and Aaron Leach, you know, talking about spirits so heavily, and like, you know, these are real things, and these are things that, you know, you should be focusing your practice on to help improve you, and it's not just all in your head. I mean, I've never really been a big fan of that kind of mentality of it being all in your head, which has kind of like led me away from even looking at any sort of Crowley book, because I know that that's a lot of his work. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's been an interesting shift. And a book like yours that just came out, Familiar to Me, I've been wanting a book like this for a very long time. And so like this, and I was thinking about it again, and like I think maybe a day or two later you announced that this book was coming out, and I was like, what the hell? And it was released in 2 weeks. It was great. It's a great surprise. Yeah, I did manage to get about a good chunk of the way through. My reading skills suck, and I have to like reread like 3 chapters over and over again. But no, I'm heavily enjoying this book, and there's so much meaty information in there, and I can't wait to like fully devour into it and finish it up. But I do have some questions for you about the book.
Great.
What level of experience would you say someone should have before looking into like gaining a familiar or even thinking about starting that kind of practice?
Well, I think some of it kind of depends on what type of familiar and what type of familiar relationship you're developing. But mm-hmm. I think there's also an expectation from a lot of people that it has to be something that's way down the line or something that is once you have a lot of experience. And in the first section of the book, one of the things I talk about is how when you're looking at witches, traditionally a lot of times witches will start their practice with obtaining a familiar, and the familiar is mm-hmm. the one that teaches the witch witchcraft. Whereas from more of the sorcery perspective or the kind of call and conjure perspective, the magician might study a lot of magic books, might learn a lot of like prayers and preparations and build all their tools and then conjure a few spirits and get used to doing that, explore some other magical techniques, and then they might conjure a spirit and ask for a familiar. And so in that context, it tends to be something that's a little more down the line, whereas from the witchcraft perspective, it's usually a little bit more upfront and in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So I think that shows that there's a range where different experience levels can work for this, and it just might look differently. Towards the end of the book, there's a significant portion that deals with sex magic from a modern ceremonial perspective and the idea of marrying an elemental familiar, and kind of involves some Enochian elements to it. And I think mm-hmm. that is stuff where it's not necessarily a significantly more advanced type of familiar, but the relationship being developed there is a little more intimate, and the methods being used for it are a little bit more intermediate to advanced. And so working that particular mode of working with a familiar spirit, that might be for someone who's a more intermediate or advanced magician, whereas going down to the crossroads and meeting the witch's devil or the fairy queen and making an offering and asking for a familiar, that might be something that you could do a little more at the beginning of your magical career. And in the middle section of the book, where it talks about kind of pagan perspectives on this, it does go through what this looks like from more of a neo-pagan perspective as opposed to more of a reconstructed or traditionalist pagan perspective. Mm-hmm. And there we talk about working with like spirits of dead animals, because they're a little bit more accessible, a little bit safer. And with the methods that are typical for neo-paganism, you could work that kind of spirit relationship without needing the extra protective elements that you get from some more formal ritual systems. And so that kind of approach, again, would be one that would be great for a beginner if they want to kind of dip their toe in. And I think it's something where sometimes people look at it and they think, okay, I'm going to have this one familiar that I work with forever, and it's just going to be the one. But you might have relationships with familiars where it lasts for several years, and then things kind of go a different direction, or you might have a couple different familiars you work with at the same time. So the idea of someone who's starting out trying one of these methods that is a little more accessible doesn't mean they're stuck where this is all they've got forever. Mm-hmm. You can do that. You can start out, you can get your feet wet and kind of run with the ball and have some cool experiences. And then over time, as you develop, if you want to explore more things, that option is still there.
Yeah, I think I personally, like, I've never really had like a, I guess, a formal starting point of like working with familiars. It's always been something that's interested me. But I did have an instance a few years ago. I want to say it was back in probably about 10 years ago now, where I was just doing like some magical working, like here and there. I don't even remember what specifically it was, but then I remember the spirit came up to me, and it was just kind of there with me every time I would do any sort of like astral travel or whatever. And then I want to say maybe a year and a half later, after working with the spirit, I had went to a it was like a neo-pagan like Yule gathering that they did for like a weekend down in Miami. And one of the main rituals was focused on Hecate. And in sort of like this, the ritual that they were doing, part of like the meditation and process of that, one of the priestesses was like, you know, give her an offering to Hecate. And immediately my, like, I guess the spirit just like appeared next to me. And I was like, okay, I guess you're just going with her now. And then that was kind of one of those interesting moments where I felt like, I didn't notice how much like it meant to me in that moment until like it was not taken from me, but you know, I felt like this was something that I was meant to like move on from now. Mm-hmm. That I don't know if that was a familiar, but that was the only time that I felt in my practice I had ever worked with something that was like a familiar. It was very lax. It wasn't really, you know, I didn't have an altar to it. I didn't really give it offerings, as consistently as I would probably other spirits, but it was something that was just like, it was already new to me. I didn't really know how to classify it. So I've always kind of thought, you know, maybe that was my familiar, but, yeah. Moving forward. Do you feel like there is any sort of necessary, I guess, spirit skills you might need, in order to start working with familiars? Or is it something that you can develop over time? In the sense of like, you know, do you need to have some sort of like psychic abilities or sorts, or can you just do like, you know, divination, or can they communicate with you in other ways?
I think having some skills developed is definitely helpful. But again, since there are people where it's like this is something that happens right at the beginning of it for them, then it might not be necessary to have spent a lot of time developing those sorts of skills. I think for people who kind of have this as something that's at the outset of their magical experience and career, those are people where those skills are sort of naturally present, and that mm-hmm. gets into some of the historical concepts of witchcraft and witch blood, where people are sort of born to witchcraft and have that connection with the spirit world already. And so for people like that, then it's something where you're already going to have a foot in that world. And you're mm-hmm. already going to have connections to it and abilities to perceive things there. And so it may not be something where you've developed skills as much as have certain talents that kind of allow you to have that interaction. And then the spirit will help cultivate that for you. But mm-hmm. I think even for people who don't have that innately already, or don't have that connection, or don't have those talents, if it's something that they're building, then as long as they can find some way to communicate with the spirit without having to perceive it directly, then they can also work with the spirit on developing that perception. So if you're using systems of divination, which even if you have those psychic perceptions and the ability to kind of pick up inspiration, pick up sensations, hear messages, see spirits, it's still good to check all of that with divination, because mm-hmm. while you still have to interpret the divination and it's still somewhat subjective, it has an element that's a little more objective than just what you're picking up psychically. And so mm-hmm. it's a good way of checking your filters and making sure that it's not just you injecting a bunch of your personal thoughts or hopes or wishes and believing that it's spirit communication. So I think whether you have those skills or not, or those talents or not, you still want to use those other methods.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I definitely tell... I think I mentioned it on an episode before, you know, when working with any type of spirit, it's always good to have some other sort of check, just to make sure, you know, it's not all, you know, I don't like to say that it's all in your head, but you always want to make sure that you're not essentially inflating your own ego and kind of manifesting these discussions that you're having. You know, you want to make sure that you're having an authentic experience, and it's not just like you just talking to yourself. Mm-hmm. When interacting with a familiar, what would you say would be, you know, how do you develop that type of relationship, like in the offering sense? Like, you know, how do you learn what kind of offerings that they like? Do you kind of just have to like try them all and just see which one it likes? And, or, you know, is it a little bit more forward? Or do you find it to be a little bit more forward? Like, hey, you know, bring me red roses on this day and, you know, I'll be your buddy.
I think a lot of these things can kind of depend because the relationships are very personal and different types of spirits will have different preferences and ways of communicating. I think it's a really good, important idea to start the relationship if you're starting it formally with like a pact or agreement to say, okay, these are the baseline things that I'm going to offer regularly and sort of tell the familiar spirit, like, you can expect that I'm going to give you incense and water, or you can expect that I'm going to give you these liquors, or you can expect that I'll give you this type of food or flower or herb or plant. And so having that kind of expectation at the beginning, you sort of know what your baseline is for what you have to do to maintain the relationship. And the familiar also then knows what it's getting into and what it's going to get out of it. From there, you can kind of communicate and it can tell you more things that it wants and what it might want in a specific situation. And sometimes like it can be surprising, not so much working with familiars, but working with my ancestors, I've had times where they'll ask for something really specific and I'm just like, okay, sure. I can do that. That's not the normal thing that I would get you, but all right. Like there was one time where they wanted gelt, the chocolate coins, and like I don't know why, but sure. And like I usually offer whiskey, but there's been a handful of times where they're like, for this thing we want rum instead, and I'm like, okay, sure, you can have rum. Like, and then sometimes things will be actions. Like they'll be like, okay, we'll help you with this, but we want you to go do this thing. Like this is a thing that needs to be done, and so you should go do that. And that's something that I think historically looking at accounts of familiar spirits, we see that with them too. Bessie Dunlop, a witch from Scotland, her familiar was a ghost, and there was a point where she had to go to a neighboring town to talk to his family and kind of relay some messages to his family as something that she was kind of doing in payment for the help that he was giving her. So your offerings can be your pretty straightforward things. Like Jason Miller talks about going out and offering incense and water every day to your overall group of spirits that you work with. It can be basic things like that, or candlelight and whiskey are things that we commonly see with contemporary magicians. But it could also be stuff like going and cleaning up some space that is connected to the spirit, or going and doing charity that connects with the type of work that the spirit's related to, or those are, I guess, kind of both sort of nice sort of actions to do. I'm sure there could be some where it's like they're a little more off the wall and less obvious, but it's going to depend on the spirit and the relationship and what the spirit's needs are. But they will communicate things to you like that over time once you learn to listen.
Do you ever find that, you know, when you're, I guess, crafting up a pact, that the spirit's just like, nah, bruh, I'm good?
I had an instance recently where this wasn't work with a familiar, but where I conjured a demon to ask for something. And before I asked for it, the demon's like, here's a name and a seal. You can have this familiar spirit. And I'm like, what? And I feel like it was something where the demon didn't want to be bothered, and so it was trying to like deflect me off. Like, here's this other thing you can have. Don't ask me your question. And but yeah, you will also get that sometimes where spirits are just like, no, that's not really something I do, or no, I don't really think that's a good thing. I don't want to help you with that. And I think that kind of goes into when people are sort of determining what type of spirit to turn to for help with something, then that can be a factor there where like if you're working with angels, a lot of times they're going to look at how to develop you and how to like push you forward to be like a good person, or to be like the best version of yourself, or how like your own lifestyle choices can help manifest the things that you want, whereas a demon might just be more, okay, I'm gonna go get it done. and a fairy might have some things that the fairy wants in particular. If you're working with your ancestors, they might have things that they want you to do that deal with, like, how to be a good family member, and or again, helping you be the person that they think that you should be. And so those factors, when you're looking at, like, the type of spirits you're going to, it's kind of like the type of person you're going to if you're going to talk with a regular person in the physical world too, where they're going to have their own interests and predilections and their expectations. And so that will play into what things that they'll be more apt to help you with and how they will tend to help you with them.
Yeah, I had in when I was doing my my craft training down in Miami in my tradition, we had a coven sibling of mine had this innate ability to just, like, every week they were working with a different god, and it kind of came a little bit of a joke for us. And one of the things that I remember my priestess telling us was that, you know, you want to limit the amount of deities that you're working with, because you don't want to just have, like, a full party every single time. You got to do all these offerings to all these people, and you're not maintaining a good relationship with all of them when you have, like, 20. Mm-hmm. Would you say that's the same for familiars, or would you say that they're a little bit easier to build that relationship with if you do have more than one, considering that, you know, you don't want to have... One is not going to be the end-all be-all for all any type of situation that you're in.
I think for most people, you're not going to have tons and tons of familiar spirits. I think a lot of people look at, in contemporary magic, look at any sort of talisman or pentacle or even magical tools as things that house spirits. But I think the way that people look at those spirits, it's a little bit different, that a lot of times they are sort of worker extensions of the larger spirits that are used mm-hmm. to consecrate them. And so you might have some personal interactions with those tools and devices and the spirits that inhabit them. But for the most part, they're just kind of doing their thing, and you're not developing, like, a working relationship.
A devotional practice.
Yeah. And so I think gotcha. That's something where you might have a little bit more spirit involvement that is a broader range, but where you're not diving into, like, okay, I've got to make offerings for all of these things and do all this devotional work with all these things. I think also, like, as you start working with, like, nature spirits and, like, the spirits of the places that you inhabit, and that's more than just your home. Like, if you have a place that you work or places that you go routinely, knowing the spirits of those places can be a good thing. And those aren't necessarily spirits where you have a familiar relationship, even if you're familiar with those spirits, like, even if you kind of know them and talk to them or make offerings regularly. And I think those are things that can be a little bit more low maintenance. And so having that as, like, a multiple interaction type thing doesn't become too big of a deal. But yeah, if you were trying to juggle, like, okay, I've got my 30 familiars, then it's like, well, what's the point of that? Like, why, what are you getting out of having so many, and how are you
overcompensating
meaningfully? Yeah. And I think there is kind of a way where you can work having a bunch of different spirits that you work with. And that's kind of like the spirit court idea, where it's like, you might have, like, your various ancestors, some spirit guides, maybe some gods that you work with, and some saints or other spirits as well. And you can kind of, like, work with them as a collective as you develop that sort of relationship with them. And that's a little different than the work you're going to do with a familiar. But if you're working with multiple spirits at once for something, then having, like, a key spirit that's sort of like your intermediary that you go to, and you can make offerings through that intermediary, who can then kind of manage sort of doling out portions of that offering to the various
spirits, like distributing.
Yeah, then that's something that you'll see in some traditions, and it seems to work very well, I think.
Now, you mentioned in a part of the book talking about blood being used as an offering. What about blood gives sustenance to a non-corporeal spirit?
So I think an interesting thing with blood is blood is something that sustains life in a way where we can't make it synthetically. Like, and this is actually something where in my upcoming book on witchcraft and witch blood, I looked at some medical papers and journals about this, and sort of what the process has been over the last 100 years or so with people attempting to make synthetic blood. And they'll kind of get close. They'll get to where you can do something that can fill out and help with if you have real blood but don't have enough of it, or mm-hmm. you can use it to sustain for like a brief period of time but not on an ongoing basis. And so there's something about blood that is special. It's something that we can't really mimic. And I think from an occult perspective, we can understand that as it's the thing that runs through your body and keeps your body going and connects things and carries the elements you need to live through your body in a physical sense. So in an esoteric sense, on that sort of spiritual level or spiritual hypostasis, it is also the thing that is carrying through the energetic elements and the life force elements. And we see some traditions that do map kind of like paths that the life force moves through the body, and they'll map those along with the circulatory system or sometimes along with the nervous system. And so I think there's a reason for that. I think it has to do with the fact that blood ties to that force and that energy. And when you look at most forms of blood magic, it's based in that, the idea that there's this life force that the blood carries through. And it's sort of, we can't like put our hands together and project energy out to the point of creating like a physical object that can be held. Blood is sort of naturally that. Blood has that energy tied to it, and so it becomes a physical means of transmitting it. And so when we offer blood, then whether it's blood from an animal or blood from ourselves, then we're offering kind of the direct crystallization of life force.
Now, would you say that there might be instances where it might be, I guess, dangerous, or you should move forward with caution whenever giving a spirit blood?
Oh, definitely. I know there are some people who are like, you should never give any blood at all to any spirit. And that super goes against history and tradition and living traditions mm-hmm. in tons of parts of the world. It's to the point where it's just kind of a silly idea that like no real magician would ever do this. But you get some popular authors who take that position. You also get some who are like, it's okay to give blood, but you should never give your own blood. But again, tons of history, tons of cultures where that is something that happens. I think it's something where you have to be kind of measured and consider consequences, consider the connections you're building, because there is a link mm-hmm. that develops there. And so yeah. there's some spirits where you're going to want that intimate link and that intimate connection that's created with that. And there's going to be some that you don't. And so even if you have something that's a familiar, you might not want to jump in with that right away. You might want to get to know the spirit, make sure it's something where you want that level of familiarity, because there's mm-hmm. different levels of connection you can have even with a familiar spirit. There's some where it's like that's going to be a big thing that they want, but you don't necessarily have to develop those relationships if that's not something you're comfortable with. And so I think it is something where you want to be cautious. You want to look at the spirit, look at the relationship, look at the implications of that, and decide if that's something you want to enter into or not. And then when you are doing it, it's just really important to remember, like, this is not something where you need to be slicing your arm open or harming yourself in some way. Get like a diabetic lancet and get a couple drops, or like take a pin, sterilize the mm-hmm. pin, get a couple drops. Like that's really all you need in most cases. And I would say if you are someone where you have struggles in life that connect to that with any sort of self-harm, then avoid that sort of work. There's mm-hmm. plenty of spirits you can work with. There's plenty of opportunities for magic, and that does not have to be the type you do if that's something where it could potentially be triggering or could potentially put elements of your health or well-being at risk.
Thanks for adding that last bit. One of the things that I really enjoyed about this book was that your focus on like familiar spirits from like the variety of different magical practices, both like historical and contemporary. Was there anything new that you learned in your research for this book that really stuck out to you?
I think the material at the end with the kind of Enochian sex magic for marrying an elemental spirit, that was super exciting to me, because it was not part of the original manuscript of the book. The original manuscript of the book was like a third of the length that the final book was. And it was just, I ended up having about 8 months stepped away from the book. And when I came back, I was like, oh, I should talk about these things. And so the entirety of section two was added. And then as I was going through and re-editing section three, I was like, you know, I kind of talk about how these things fit into the modern systems for the Golden Dawn and Thelema and the AA, but I don't actually present what they look like in those systems. I should probably do that. And so as I started looking at how to present those and how to connect them and pulling more information about how it wasn't just theoretical that these things were part of those systems, but that you can actually see examples of it. I found a master's thesis that someone wrote about the Golden Dawn and Comte de Gablet and the marrying of an elemental. And that ended up opening the door to researching a bunch of stuff about some of the individual Golden Dawn members and their practices, and then looking at how that related to some of Crowley's material. And it was just surprising to me that sex magic was such a big part of the lives of Golden Dawn members, because we always kind of talk about how the Golden Dawn didn't do sex magic, and that that's just a thing Crowley was really obsessed with and that he kind of added, which there's lots of sex magic before Crowley, obviously, even in kind of modern magic. But then also looking at it, like, we always kind of have this impression that Crowley was not involved in spirit magic, because some of his early writings, he talks about things from a very psychological perspective. And then there's points in his later writings where he walks all that back and he talks about the Holy Guardian Angel as a real being that's separate from you. And he talks about spirits as being real. But even most of the work that's put out that kind of describes work he does doesn't really address those things. It's either the sex magic stuff, or it's things that are just about being kind of this big personality that is bucking the system, or kind of psychological things. And in fact, I think sometimes it may be better to read Crowley as someone who's writing partially about mysticism, partially about nascent psychology, and partially about nascent queer theory, than someone who's writing about magic at all. But looking at some of the things related to familiars and the elementals, there's definitely elements that kind of indicate that there was some spirit work going on for him as well as for the Golden Dawn members. And that was really interesting to me, particularly with kind of changing the perspective on how much spirit work and how much sex magic was going on for some of the Golden Dawn practitioners.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I remember, actually before you got on, I was looking through the book and I saw that section and I skimmed a little bit of it, but it reminded me of, there was a story of Alexander's and one of his kind of mates, lovers, I'm not really sure what the other person was, but they ended up doing this ritual to essentially create this spirit. I want to say they named him Michael, and that was like their spirit baby that they made together. It was, they kind of, I guess, treated it more of like, you know, along the lines of, you know, this is our familiar, but we created him together. I always thought that was interesting story, but it's funny to see that, you know, there's a lot more, I guess, historical context for, you know, marrying spirits and having those types of sexual relationships with spirits that, I guess, if you think about it, it sounds weird, but I guess there's a lot more context that goes into it and usefulness. Because I've definitely been told by many people that sex magic is probably one of the more potent forms of magic that's out there. And for me personally, I'm just thinking, I'm not really there yet. But moving on from that, though, you know, there's a lot of grimoire conjurations that use God in the Abrahamic sense of God as kind of like the supreme being of their, they're kind of using that as a sense of like, this is who I'm getting power from to call upon, you know, whether it's any sort of like demons or spirits. How much do you think that effectiveness would change if the person, you know, is not necessarily connected with that Abrahamic God and they are more either part of a different initiatory witchcraft tradition, or they have different devotionals to other deities? Do you feel like it would still be important for them to do it the way that those grimoires say that to do it, essentially invoking God? Or is it more important to focus on the spirits or the deities that you have a connection built already with?
I think there's a lot of perspectives on that question. And magic is one of those things where because it doesn't operate like a hard physical science, it's hard to nail down solid specific answers as far as what the best way to approach those things is. To me, I think if you don't like approaching those systems from kind of a traditional Christian perspective, then looking at more of a Gnostic or Neoplatonic perspective, more of the idea of God as the one and the good and something that is beyond characteristic and is not anthropomorphized and is more of the initial creative force behind existence, then that can be a way to approach that and still use those names and not feel like you're trying to pretend to be part of a religious system that you're not part of. And I think that can be effective. I think for people where it's like they have serious baggage there, or they just really are not comfortable with it, or they feel that it's a violation for other religious practices that they're part of, and they feel like they just really can't use those names, then there's different ways to look at it. I think is the easy answer may be don't do the grimoires and pick other spirits to work with. Or you might be able to dig around and look at, are some of these spirits that seem to occur in other traditions or other systems? Are there ways to approach the spirits directly rather than trying to conjure and bind them by these divine names? Or are there other divine powers that might work as well? And I think different people have found different answers experimenting with those things. I think some of it can come down to the practitioner as well. Julio Cesar Oddi pointed out that while things like the Key of Solomon or those grimoire texts, that they're effective because someone was able to bind the spirits using that method and get the spirits to agree to follow the rituals in that method and follow the things in that book, and they included the spirits in the book that agreed to do that. And so if you mimic those methods and try to do them as best as you can, then the spirits are obligated to agree to them. And so that's something from the perspective that someone who doesn't have their own power, they can kind of approach the spirits that way and work it that way. But Oddi went on to point out that it's possible that you could have people who are witches who have their own power and their own capability to engage and manipulate spirits, that they might be able to develop other systems and call on spirits and get the spirits to swear to work those systems. And that would be a way that new systems could be developed. And I think that kind of plays into the idea that someone had to create those rituals and bind the spirits to them to begin with. And so you have to have people occasionally who have the power to do that, whether they have a set ritual that the spirits have agreed to work with or names that the spirits have agreed to work with. Another thing to consider there is that throughout history, these systems and approaches have existed. Our earliest human writing includes examples of exorcism rituals and rituals to bind spirits and conjure spirits using divine names. So it's clear that it's not only the Abrahamic system that does that, and that's not the only set of divine names or divine understandings that has that power. So looking at other systems that have done that, looking at the Greco-Egyptian material, looking at the Akkadian material, you can go back and pull other systems that have done those things and build things like that. One thing that I've been looking at, and I kind of get to that somewhat in part two of the Familiar Unto Me, is the idea of looking at more Northern European paganism and how you can build systems for that with that. I know Ian Corrigan has written a lot in that direction as well. And Simon Dida has also kind of talked about some things in that direction that are interesting as far as looking at the Mabinogi and the Arthurian legends and how there's elements that kind of set up those sort of spirit courts and spirit conjuration methods based on the idea of undergoing trials and then naming the court of spirits and naming your connections to the leaders of that court. So I think there are ways to build that in a pagan context as well. There are ways to build it in a witchcraft context. I think it's stuff where people just need to kind of explore and experiment. And I might have some stuff that I'm writing that deals with that that may come out at some point, but it's not the stuff that's the next two major projects. So it may be a little further down the line.
Oh, that sounds pretty awesome. I can't wait for that to come out. Is it going to be another surprise drop?
They probably mostly will be, yeah.
Okay, cool. Brings down my anxiety when I don't have to wait that long. All right, so I do have some other questions from a buddy of mine, Silver Daniels. First, he wants me to say hi. Just imagine a very loud screech noise.
That sounds like hi. That is me. I didn't realize that's who you meant when you said Silver. So hello, yeah. Silver.
I'm sure he's messaged you multiple times. He wanted to ask me to have you expand on your understanding of the witch blood. Now, you did mention that this is going to be probably an upcoming book. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a little bit ago, but what is your understanding of, you know, how the witch blood works or functions?
Okay, so it is an upcoming book, and the goal for that is this June. So
Sweet.
Hopefully that'll be pretty soon. I'm doing it's another one where I had a completed manuscript. At this point, it's been most of a year that I've kind of stepped away from it. And so now I'm doing rewrites and doing a lot of research of a lot of academic texts and journal articles, going through and expanding and adding additional material that I think will be of interest and be useful, looking both at historical examples, but also looking at other living cultural examples around the world. And so I'm pretty excited about that. But as far as my understanding of that goes, I think sometimes people get hung up on the word blood there, and they assume that it is something that works in a genetic sense or a purely physical, like, blood sense. And I have always been pretty agnostic about those elements. I don't think that very many people who seriously address that concept are really hung up or stuck on the idea that it operates through normal genetic processes, or that it's like you could do physical things with blood and identify it that way. It has more to do with spiritual components that are attached to families. And so you could have things like in the Norse context, the Atrefylgja, where you have a spirit that follows a family and is connected to a family, and each generation it has people in the family that it interacts with and deals with. And so that's a way that you could have the passage of a magical and spiritual capability along the lines of a family that is something that is still part of a living culture. There are still Icelandic concepts around these inherited spirits. And I don't think that that necessarily equates to the idea of witch blood, but it's an example of how those things can pass in families in a spiritual sense that isn't exactly the same genetic or blood relationship by which we pass eye color or something like that. So there's the element that it can have to do with spirit connections and relationships with spirits. People are really, really into the idea of generational curses these days. And I've talked with some friends in sort of traditional living magical cultures, and they're like, yeah, it's a thing. It's not a thing the way that Americans talk about it. And it's not something where every single person is dealing with, like, these generational curses. But a lot of times it will be similar to that same kind of thing as, like, a spirit that follows a family and has interactions with the family. And in sometimes it can be a negative thing, sometimes it can be a positive thing, and it can just be about perspective, where there might be this connection with spirit, and so the spirit might do things for you or cause you to be able to see or know things or experience things. And if it's something where you find that to be good and helpful, then it's not so much a curse. But if you're just like, oh my God, I'm a bad Catholic because this spirit that I inherited from my mom is telling me things about the future, then that might feel like a curse. And so again, not necessarily the same thing, but definitely a related thing. In a lot of traditional cultures, there are multiple different types of magic workers. And I think a thing that we have lost in modern modern magic in the Anglosphere is the idea that magic is diverse. Magic is not one monolithic structure where everyone's engagement of it is the same, where all forms of magical power and agency are the same, and where everything is towards the same end. Like, we're starting to move away from that idea that all roads lead to the same place and all systems are just different ways of saying the same thing, and it's all the same goal from system to system. And I think that's great that we're starting to recognize that different cultures might have different spiritual goals and different magical goals, and that not all magic and not all religion and not all spirituality have to be towards the same end or the same purpose. But I think that we also need to recognize that there are different ways to engage spirits. There are different ways to engage magic. There's different ways to engage the world, and there's different types of power out there, and people can engage them differently. And so saying that there are some people who have a particular type of engagement and that's what makes this particular type of magic work the thing that it is, I don't think that's something where it has to be about valuation, or it has to be about gatekeeping, or it has to be about exclusivity. Saying that there's lots of different valid relationships with magic and approaches to magic, and that those things can have different words and names that describe them, I think is a very necessary thing. And that's mostly the angle that I've been kind of trying to take with clarifying, defining what witchcraft is and defining what witches are, as opposed to just the perspective that it's like, hey, Lord goes out and has concerts and dresses kind of funny, and that's kind of witchy. Or Stevie Nicks says she's not a witch, but she wears those long black dresses, and that's kind of witchy. I think there can be more meaning to it than that. Yeah. And I think
just the aesthetic.
And yeah, it's not just about like having an aesthetic or having like a connection to archetypes that make you feel powerful or connection to certain political things. It's about having a connection to magic and being able to engage magic in particular ways. And I think what witch blood is the idea that witchcraft isn't simply a skill or a set of techniques. Witchcraft is a power, and that power shapes and conducts who the person is and what their relationship with magic is. And that relationship with magic is one where you're naturally between the human world and the spirit world. You're naturally in a liminal queer state that is kind of quantum, where it sort of moves from one thing to another, and you can't necessarily nail down or identify all the elements of it all at once. And the ability to sort of move those probabilities and possibilities through you and kind of select the path through the crossroads that manifestation comes through by interacting with those things through yourself. And I think that's a very different description of magic than what we talk about when we're talking about ceremonial magic, or when we're talking about contemporary neo-pagan witchcraft, or talking about a lot of different approaches and systems of magic. The idea that it's about your liminality and the space that you create within yourself in conjunction with the world around you and the spirit world and the spirits that you're dealing with and the past and the future and the potentials that are moving through you. And so when we talk about witch blood, it's the othering factor, that witch fire or witch power that passes through people and kind of creates that othering thing that makes them somewhat supernatural, somewhat different than what the norm or the standard is. And I don't think that necessarily means that people who have that are the real magical people, or who are better or more fit to be magical or do magic. There's lots of different ways that magic can work. And looking back historically, there's a lot of different things that can identify someone as being prone to magic, and it'll be different types of magic. Agrippa and I think Reginald Scott talk about being born under certain signs, creating certain dispositions in people that make them more prone to necromancy and make them more fit for that type of work. In a lot of cultures, you have things like being born with the cowl, or in some places being born with blue eyes, or like an array of different things, being born at certain times of the year. That would mark someone as having an obligation to connection and activity with certain supernatural capabilities or experiences. And I think that's something that is kind of foreign to a lot of modern people, the idea that magic is not always voluntary, magic's not always something that you select, but that there are certain things that it's that are just going to be part of you and who mm-hmm. you are, but that there are other types of magic that are fully voluntary and are fully things that people can select, and they can be equally powerful and interesting and equally things that are worth pursuing. It's just they work differently and they behave differently, and the experience that a person will have with them is different. And so that's a lot of what I'll be exploring as I write and present about Witchblood.
Well, that sounds fascinating and exciting, and I can't wait to read it. So the next question I have from Silver is, aside from Tobias, and we talked a little bit about this earlier, but Tobias is the familiar that you guys developed at the Lodge, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So he's saying, besides Tobias, do you have any other familiars, and you know, what kind of relationship does that look like in practice?
I don't tend to think of the spirit that I grew up with as a familiar, but it's definitely that same relationship. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school, there was a spirit that I developed a relationship with, or was sort of given a relationship with. And I think in modern magic, we don't talk about dragons ever. No one ever is like, yeah, I work with dragons. And because it's like, okay, go roll your dice somewhere. I think there's definitely a handful of magicians that I've met where they're like, when you get them talking personally, they're like, oh yeah, and then this thing with dragons, and it was pretty important to my development. And I definitely had some dragon stuff going on at one point, and it is something that I'd like to explore more at some point to get out there, so it can become kind of a thing that more people can look at and explore, and doesn't have to be like the weird, like, okay, we get that fairies can be part of formal magic, but who's talking about dragons? But that was one of my earliest familiar spirit relationships, was kind of a dragon spirit that mm-hmm. I was given to work with as we both developed. And that was interesting and lasted for a couple years. And then there was some stuff where it's like, okay, we've kind of run our course and done some things, and that spirit was able to sort of move on and go do its own things after that. I also have two familiar spirits that I work with that I acquired in, you mentioned WGN Salem earlier. Mm-hmm. In the book, I talk about how Chilling Adventures of Sabrina is a good example of contemporary media that treats the familiar in a mm-hmm. More accurate way, and how as we start to get more media like that, maybe we'll get more ideas out there that connect to more accurate material. And that series was great because like everyone in the writer's room was a magician from what I hear. And
oh, really?
Yeah, so like I think Matt Oren did an interview with one of the main writers of the show, and he was kind of like, yeah, everyone's got some connection to magic or has explored some element of it, so that's kind of reflected in the show. And when you watch, particularly season one and somewhat season two, maybe less so as you get to season three and four, there's a lot of things where the spells that they do, it's like you look at that, you're like, oh, that could easily be amended to yeah. like an actual like magical ritual or spell. And so I did an event where I presented a lecture talking about elements of witchcraft and magic as they appear in the media and in history versus what is necessarily common in modern practice, and use Chilling Adventures of Sabrina as kind of a focal point for like guiding the discussion and what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And then we did a ritual that drew on the aesthetic of that series and took elements from some of the magic presented in that series to do a ritual for people to sign their names in the Book of the Beast and go and kind of have their own dark baptism and obtain a familiar spirit from the witch's devil. And it was very well attended and very popular, and it seemed to work very well. A lot of people have told me about experiences they had with the familiars that they obtained through that ritual and things they've done to kind of verify the experiences they've had. And so it seems like it was very successful for a lot of people. And I had two spirits that were presented to me in that ritual, and they're kind of the familiars that I currently work with. And it's something where I don't think I was expecting that at the time. Mm-hmm. And so it's been less consistent than some work with familiars has been for me. But I have little touch points for them that are in my room, my bedroom, and there's things that I'll ask them about and offerings I'll make for them from time to time. Probably something that I could dive into more deeply with them, but they have been useful and helpful for several things. So,
well, that's pretty neat. It's kind of funny that you bring up the dragon thing, because I was also one of those people that was like, all right, dragon's a little too much for me. But I actually had an experience with my training coven where I went to go do like the the summoning of the quarters of like the elementals, and randomly these weird dragon images started popping up in my head. They were different for every quarter. Mm-hmm. And then like I brought it up later on, my priestess was, and I didn't know this about my priestess at the time, but she was like, yeah, one of the main spirits I work with is a dragon. And I'm like, what? What do you mean? And then like every time I did it, I would see those specific spirits. But then when I left that group and I moved away, anytime like it's a different spirit that comes. Mm-hmm. So I always kind of found that fascinating, that like just within essentially her circle, that's where I had that connection with those dragon spirits, whereas anywhere else in my life, that's never happened before. So I guess that can kind of touch into that process of like, I guess like you were saying before, like the witch blood and that passing of that connection to those spirits, to people whom you are building that magical connection with. So I thought that was pretty interesting. I didn't really think about that until right now. last question from Silver. How did you come to work with Hecate, and how has she improved and impacted your practice?
Oh, that is probably the toughest question that you've asked, because like I remember back when I released Living Spirits and mm-hmm. talking with some friends, and I was like, well, I'm not a big Hecate guy. I'm not like Jason or Jack or any of those guys where it's like Hecate is like the big spirit that they kind of deal with and interact with and put out there. And some of my friends just kind of looked at me and they're like, BJ, every part of your book, like Hecate is involved in every single practical or ritual element of it, and you have this huge section about Hecate, and then there's like a second subsection about Hecate, and then an additional Hecate ritual in addition to her showing up as a reference in like all the other ritual work. And then Luminarium comes out and it's like, okay, Hecate again is central to the operation of this basically grimoire ritual that you've put together. And so I'm like, well, I mean, I also like pray to Hecate every day. And they're like, PJ, maybe you're a Hecate guy. And so I'm not really sure how that all started. I'm trying to think back, and I can't really pinpoint where it was. I think it was just it probably connected with as I started doing Dionysian work. And mm-hmm. Like I'm actually like involved in forming a Dionysian church and kind of view myself as a Dionysian priest. I've run a Dionysian mystery system for like 10 years now. And
oh, wow.
Some of the Dionysian work and working with trying to look at historical witchcraft around the same time and beginning to work more with like traditional Greek necromancy and sort of the kind of underworld mysteries there. I think all of that culminated into some of my early experiences with a force or power that could be understood as the witch's devil, and mm-hmm. that also connected with some of the Hecate stuff. There was also an initiation into the Eleusinian mysteries that I took back probably 2007-ish, and that was kind of leading into some of those other things happening. And so all of that probably was where that got started and where that culminated. I'm not sure about before that if there was more Hecate stuff, but I think it was probably somewhere in that range of 2007 to 2012, kind of digging into the Eleusinian stuff, digging into Greek underworld stuff and Greek necromancy and witchcraft, drawing on Greek and Roman elements, and working with Dionysus and kind of connecting with the Chthonic forces through the very vibrant and lively Dionysian current that on the surface you would not think is Chthonic at all, but very much connects to those powers as well. And so I think that's probably where a lot of that initially came in. But I think the reason that I didn't think of myself as like a Hecate guy initially is, I guess that's a thing, the Hecate guys. But it was just that a lot of it was not like gods that I've been devoted to. Usually it's a very interactive, communicative relationship, where with Hecate, it's much more this overarching power that's there behind everything and involved in everything. And she's kind of like, I have to touch all the magic you do, but we don't have to like sit and have conversations. And there are points where like I've been like, okay, I need to like try to dive deeper into that and explore that. And sometimes it was very tough to kind of develop that kind of interaction or that relationship. And a lot of it from her was kind of like, well, stop trying to push it and just let go and let it happen. And then I was able to get some stuff from her where she like provided some very instructive things and some very useful things. I think a couple nights ago, I was looking at a contemporary like neo-pagan prayer to her and was sort of like, I don't know how much I like this. And because it kind of leaned into the very, Hecate is so dark and spooky, and like, and every portrayal of her is always like she's this dark-haired vixen, or she's this like creepy crone, and it's like the crone thing wasn't associated with her until like 70 years ago, and her first literary reference, she's described as bright-haired, but everyone always depicts her with like super dark hair, and so. It was like this voice was just like, okay, well, write something different, write this thing and include these elements. And like, it was like this structure was sort of presented and some images were presented. And then she's just like, okay, run with it, put your words behind these things. And so it was just like sort of sitting in bed and like having Hecate help me write this prayer ritual under her. And so it's like, she's kind of part of everything, but is very in the background, touching everything, reaching out into everything, expanding through everything, as opposed to being super in your face about things, at least for me. Which is also kind of how my experience of the Witch's Devil is very much a moves through things, touches things, kind of the tendrils and vines that reach through the world and connect things and move them. But not necessarily the guy that's going to sit and have coffee and talk with you. And so I think it can be hard to like look at how those relationships start when they are things that kind of bubble up and become part of everything without being like the immediate face of everything. Although I guess looking at a lot of my work, like you would think she is the face of everything. I remember I was with a group of magicians who I used to, we used to kind of meet at bars and talk about what we were doing magically. And we were all people who had done the Abramelin ritual. And it was kind of pretty cool to have a local group of a bunch of Abramelin people. And one day we were talking about how Crowley had the wrong H, that this was not the Aeon of Horus, it's the Aeon of Hecate. And because if you look back 20, 30 years ago, no one was talking about Hecate. Like, she wasn't like a big figure in the neo-pagan witchcraft community. Grimoire people weren't talking about Hecate. Like, she wasn't like the big sorcery or chaos magic person. But now every single tradition of magic, she is the dominant force and dominant figure. And everyone's like, yeah, she's historically always been there. It has always been like the important thing in this. And it's like, no, she grabbed it and took it really recently, and she's like got you guys like convinced that like this has always been her thing. And that's amazing. I think that is just like incredible that like you can have a god or a spirit who's just like, you know what, the world is mine now. And
like, I mean, that tracks for her.
Yeah, it's the yeah. I think the far reaching, the idea of always grabbing, always expanding out, like that's mm-hmm. in her name. And I think it's sort of amazing to see that that is her interaction with the occult community and the pagan community and the neo-pagan community today, is that she's just reaching through and saying, I can expand infinitely through all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought it was funny how you mentioned the, I guess the specific like statues and the imagery that a lot of people have for her. And even when I got this statue that I have for her on my altar, and I remember specifically like looking for one and then just thinking like, you came to me as a black blob. Like, I don't, nothing, I can't get anything out of that that's going to look like that. So you're just getting this one because I think it's cool. And yeah, so that, and anytime she does like tend to like come to me, it's always in like some weird, like ambiguous shadow form. Mm-hmm. And there's no like, I don't know, like, you know, aspects of like Crone or this weird vixen with like huge tits and all this other stuff. And I'm just like, what? I don't get where everybody else is getting this imagery, but that's not what I'm getting.
Yeah, I mean, if people like scary, that imagery, that's great. That's fine. And I think that those kind of darker, spookier elements are obviously there. It's just, I think people miss that there's like so much more than just that.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, that's actually, no, I do have one final question for you. Yeah. If somebody was looking for getting into this type of work of developing these relationships with spirits, what is, you know, one thing of advice that you would give to somebody?
Well, obviously, they should pick up a copy of Familiar Unto Me.
100%.
But I think if you're looking to get into this work, I think do it is the advice. I think there's a quote from Jake Stratton Kent that's been popping up on Facebook lately about getting your fingers burnt and mm-hmm. Not sitting on the sidelines forever. And I think that has also been a thing that I've really tried to push, is that you have to get into the game and play the game to enjoy the game. If you read about it forever and think about it forever, it's just anxiety inducing. And there's some people where that's all they want. Some people, they just want to kind of study stuff and read stuff and think about it, and it's an intellectual pursuit, and that's great if that's what people are interested in. But if you want to actually be a magician and do magic, to me it's always felt like it's so much easier to grasp the material and retain it and memorize it if you're mm-hmm. using it and you're working with those powers and working with those spirits than just trying to read it and memorize everything. And you're never going to have a point where you perfectly know all the answers or know everything about a system. There's always going to be new things to learn. Your practice is always going to change and develop. There's always going to be those weird moments where someone just says something and stuff suddenly clicks and you're like, oh, I should be doing this, or I should really reshape what I'm doing and put these things together this way. And those mm-hmm. things are great. And I think a lot of it, and you mentioned earlier about with the spirit that you worked with and kind of passed on to Hecate, and that it was like a shift in your life and it was just the time for that shift and the moment for that shift. And I think there are things like that that happen where there's going to be things that aren't necessarily shaping for us, but they're moments that mark that it's mm-hmm. time for something shaping to happen, or it's time that there is going to be a change in our practice or a change in what we do. And the fact that that happens routinely and often is a good thing. And I think it's a sign that like we can't wait and just sit and say, okay, I'm not going to do this until I know all the pieces, or I'm not going to do this until I know every single element of it, because it's just never going to happen. You're going to learn a lot of it by going out and doing it. And especially for people who want to be witches specifically, like if you're doing witchcraft, whether you're going with that it's an innate power that you were born with and that's part of you, or it's something that you're acquiring through working in certain ways, it's always been something where you work with spirits and spirits teach you magic. And it's something that you learn from going out and getting your hands dirty and doing it. And so, especially for people who are called to that witch concept, you got to go out and do it. You got to go out and mm-hmm. be the witch, and you got to learn from your work, not just from books.
Well, that's fantastic advice. Thank you so much. But yeah, thank you, BJ, for coming on and talking with us today. It's been a blast. And, you know, after not having had an episode out in a year, I'm thankful that I was able to have you on.
thank you for having
me. And hopefully this will start me, you know, making more episodes. Where can listeners find a copy of your book? I know it's on Amazon, but is it available anywhere else? Is there like a direct way for people to get the book?
It's currently on Amazon. It may be available on Barnes & Noble at this point.
Okay.
I have to double check that to see if it's actually live there yet. And if it's available on Barnes & Noble, then Barnes & Noble will have a hardback edition as well as the paperback edition. There will be a hardback edition from Amazon as well, and that should be soon. I think there was like an error in a file, and it wasn't telling me there was the error. And so I've just got to fix that.
Technology.
Yeah, and then the hardback edition will go live there. Personally, I like the Barnes & Noble hardback editions better than the Amazon, just in the style. Barnes & Noble does like a slip cover, whereas Amazon, like if you like a textbook, if you want something that looks like a textbook,
gotcha.
Which honestly, this is kind of quasi-academic book and kind of works as a textbook. Amazon's will look a little more like a textbook when that hardback is out. So Amazon, hopefully also Barnes & Noble. I know Edge of the Circle Books, which is out, I think, in the Pacific Northwest. They picked up a few copies to carry in their store. I imagine they do mail order for people who don't want to deal with one of the big chains. I know there are some shops that also pick up from Amazon and will sell in their shops, but Amazon doesn't tell me who those shops are, so I can't direct people to them. But those are the two main places. And if it's something where you don't necessarily want to patronize those places and you want to see it in your local witch shop or magic shop, go talk to the shopkeeper and maybe they'll be able to carry it.
Sweet. Well, definitely go check out Familiar Unto Me, which is Sorcerers and Their Spirit Companions. Also, definitely check out Living Spirits and Luminarium by BJ. Those are fantastic books as well. And you have your new book coming out in June, hopefully.
Yes.
Crossing fingers. Is there any sort of social media that people can reach out to you? Or because I know you have a Facebook. Is there also a Facebook group for Living Spirits, if I'm not mistaken?
So, yep, I'm primarily on Facebook because I'm just very bad at social media. And so there is a group, Living Spirits, and it's actually the book is named after the group. As opposed to me making a book for the group in that case. And so it's like a really great community focused on just dealing with spirits as real living beings and how to interact with them. And it's not focused on a particular tradition. So people can kind of come at it from all angles. And it's not specifically devoted to like the work that I write in my book. It's whatever the community wants to bring to the table. And I think that's really great that it's like that. There is also a group that is specifically for Luminarium and people working with Luminarium. It's a very small group, doesn't have a lot of activity, but I would love to have people who are working with that text jump in there and share their experiences. And both of those are on Facebook. I have an author page on Facebook, BJ Swain, author of Living Spirits and Other Books or something like that. And then there's also the Glory of the Stars page on Facebook, which is primarily for my blog, Glory of the Stars, and also shares like other random things. So those are places you can see announcements about work that I'm doing and stuff that's coming out, or just following me on my personal page, BJ Swain. I've got a Twitter. I don't really use it. I'm very bad at Twitter. No one pays attention to any of my Twitter posts.
I feel that. I feel like an old man every time I get on Twitter. I'm just like, I guess I have this for the podcast, but I don't really know how to use it. What's a retweet?
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm doing. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you can join the Patreon. At the moment, we're doing a book club discussing Jason Miller's Consorting with Spirits. And I'll definitely be pushing to do BJ's book next. I think it'd be good for some great discussions. You can also find me on Instagram at feast_of_torches_podcast. Twitter, but like I said, I don't really use Twitter that much, at Feast of Torches, or you can email me at feastoftorches@gmail.com. Hail and farewell, guys, and thank you again, BJ. This has been a great talk.
Thank you.